Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We've got an awesome show for you this week. We're driving some interesting cars, the Range Rover Evoque, the Hyundai Ioniq 6, our long-term Subaru WRX, and the Tesla Model Y. It's been a busy week in the news world, the car news world. Supercharger layoffs come to Tesla. We're talking about two different V12 supercar makers. There's news out of Ferrari and Aston. Automatic emergency braking appears to be on the federal government's list of mandates for the coming years. So we'll see how that plays out. And what's next for Fisker? With that, I'll bring in Associate Editor Byron Hurd. How you doing, man?
Hey, doing pretty well. I've got a brand new garage going up in the backyard right now. So life's pretty good. Can't really complain.
I literally noticed when I saw you earlier this week, you seemed lighter. You seemed like a weight had been lifted from your shoulders. So it's funny how like sometimes home improvement chores can really, you know, just lighten the load.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been 2 years in the planning and lots of bids and no shows and all the good stuff. So to actually have a foundation going down and a slab going down is very exciting.
It's a garage. It's the Autoblog Podcast. So I think it's fitting.
Right.
All right. Cool. So let's jump into the news section. Tesla announced this week that it's basically laying off a bunch of people associated with the supercharger network, which struck me as very odd for several reasons. One, Elon Musk and Tesla were out in front of the rest of the car business on this one. They saw a need. They saw the need that people were going to need to charge their cars in an easy fashion, reliable. They didn't want to think about it. And it seemed like they got that right when literally nobody else has, not their competitors, not other charging companies, not different, you know, government agencies. They literally got it right. So I'll get to why. I don't even know why they did this, but I have some kind of random conspiracy theories, but this is a head scratcher. What do you think?
I mean, I guess the only thing you can really say to kind of like make it make sense is that they must feel like they're done with the meat of the work, right? At this point, it's just, you know, like, okay, we've got it. We've engineered it. Now all we have to do is just keep building more of it. And I mean, the one thing that kind of makes sense to me is just the notion that at this point, Tesla isn't really building superchargers just for Tesla anymore. It's building them for everybody. So, you know, they kind of had to make that deal with the government that if they were going to get any subsidies for it, they would have to open them up. And I think that's kind of killed the mood for them. Like they just don't see the point in putting a lot of in-house money into something that they're going to have to share with the rest of the world. And obviously, Musk wanted to make examples of divisions that weren't really, you know, getting hardcore with his headcount rules for reducing costs. And it just seemed like a good one to make an example of, I guess. I mean, I won't pretend to understand what goes on inside Elon Musk's head because, first of all, I don't want to. This doesn't sound right. Like a fun place to be. So yeah, I mean, that's really my best guess on the whole thing. It's Tesla. If they made sense and if they were predictable, then we probably wouldn't be where we are, right?
My guess here, to kind of bring it together, is that Elon Musk thinks of it differently than he did perhaps 2 years ago. And maybe this was his strategy all along, which is to get everybody to adapt to his standard, and then peace out. And now suddenly all of the world wants to use Tesla's chargers, and Tesla can use anybody's chargers. So it's almost like the ultimate head fake. Like, I'm going to do my own thing. You guys aren't going to use ours. Oh, you are going to use ours. Cool. This is what everybody's doing now. We're out. And maybe he thought that all along. You know, he was thinking two moves ahead of the rest of the industry. And I mean, that seems like the most logical thing because the way the superchargers are now is it's not this like cash cow for Tesla in-house. It's everybody's network. So he clearly rethought that. And my guess is he probably thought that up ahead of time. I think it's a little weird in some ways not to still look at these. But if nothing else, since we're psychoanalyzing him, he does appear to have a very flexible mind that he changes often.
Yeah, that's for sure. I don't think anyone can accuse him of being stuck in any one particular rut. So there's an ADD CEO in the world. He's a prime example of it.
All right. So let's shift gears over to V12s, from hybrids to V12s. Ferrari revealed the 812 Superfast's successor, the follow-up. Ferrari is sticking with V12s. We're recording this a little bit before the reveal itself. We know a little bit about the car, but come back to the site this weekend. Hopefully, maybe you are on your patio. The weather's supposed to be nice. Maybe you're grilling, you're sipping that second Heineken. You're in for the night, maybe, and you want to catch up on your news. Well, hey, there was a new Ferrari this week, so come back and check that out. We also had news this week that Aston Martin is going to also stay with V12s. I think this makes sense for them because this is like a niche that they could continue to invest in and create some identity. As our story says, we think it will be probably a Vanquish. So, I mean, that all sounds pretty good to me. But in broad strokes, I think it also looks at, it illustrates just how different these two car makers are. You've got Ferrari that, you know, has the racing team. They're looked at as a global luxury brand along with, like, you know, Hermes and Rolex, or I guess it's Tag Heuer. They print money. They're dabbling with these different things of expanding their portfolio. And they still have, I would say, the luxury, pun intended, of use of continuing with the V12. Whereas Aston Martin, it feels like this has got to be a success for them. Not that the Vanquish ever could be a failure, but I mean, they maybe have three or four things they do well, and this has got to be one of them. So to me, it really is just a case of, you know, David and Goliath, you know, big and small, a lot of different things at play here, but obviously Ferrari's in a much stronger place. So both cars, I'm sure, will be quite epic.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, it's interesting, you know, you look at, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you have like Jeremy Clarkson out there saying like, oh, like this V12, and I'm pretty sure it was an Aston he was driving, was going to be the last V12, but you're never going to see him again. When realistically, like people who are super rich can afford to pay gas guzzler taxes, right? So like the biggest engines in the world are the ones that are going to survive much longer. The V8 will die probably before the V12 and the V10, if you really think about it. I mean, granted, looking around right now, V10s are nowhere. Like we don't, you know, they're kind of in that weird middle space where like, yeah, they're really cool in sports cars that are going to cost people a lot of money, but they're not as cool as V12s. So if we can do V12s and you've got a reputation for doing V12s, then, you know, stay in your lane, right? So it's kind of interesting that we may see the last like pedestrian V8 truck before we see the last actual V12. And I mean, that's great for us as enthusiasts, because I mean, that's pretty awesome. But at the same time, it's a little weird to kind of think that it's going to be a smaller engine that's more likely to die before a larger one, even though the larger one is more likely to be penalized by emissions regs.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. All right, so that's Aston Martin. Let's move along to what the feds are up to. We're looking that they are going to require, this is automatic emergency braking. If you've ever wondered what AEB stands for, that's it. And it also kind of defines what this technology actually will be. I kind of chalk this up there with backup cameras. It was something that was talked about for years that just one day it happened. And it seemed like overnight every car had it. And I would argue backup cameras might be a little more, I don't want to say important, but they're usable than AEB. I feel like there's going to be a learning curve for some consumers, and some people really are not going to like it. That said, by sort of defining the parameters, and this is a pretty, you know, I would say conservative organization as far as trying to like come up with new rules. They don't try to push the ball downfield. They try to like go where they think like the ball already is. So I think, you know, when you look at how common this is already on cars, I don't think this is some enormous groundbreaking policy, but I think ultimately it will be a good thing. I do think the learning curve for consumers is gonna take a minute. Let's look at it that way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to your point, really, we're at the stage now where virtually everything has this standard already, because so many automakers over the past 3-4 years have really pushed to make their semi-autonomous driver aids standard equipment, because I mean, it looks great in reviews when they say like, yeah, all of our safety equipment's standard, you don't have to spend any extra money. And looking at it, I mean, it's really going to be only the very cheapest cars that are going to be impacted by this, because, you know, you think even, you know, I'm just driving the new Subaru Forester, everything comes with eyesight now, that's just pretty much something you have to expect. And sticking with Subaru, Subaru's actually made it possible to integrate automatic emergency braking with a manual transmission in U.S. bound cars. Now, granted, that matters only for the BRZ and the WRX because they make no other manual transmission cars anymore. But it does mean that theoretically, they could actually build manual cars with automatic emergency braking. Now, whether we're still going to have any manual transmission cars on the market in 5 years, that's a big question that I would not answer with any confidence right now. But at least kind of leaves the door open to that, perhaps from some of the more enthusiast-oriented automakers. So in any situation where you have an automaker who's building sticks just because they're kind of, you know, languishing on inertia, I feel like this is probably the beginning of the end for that. But for the few OEMs who have actually made the effort to make this work, it shouldn't be too impactful for the enthusiast buyer, at least.
To your point, over 90% of vehicles, new vehicles on sale today already have this. So it's, like I said, they're, if anything, the ball is 5 yards behind them at this point. You know, they're breaking the huddle. This is not shocking, you know, groundbreaking. But I do think it's a good thing. And some of the standards, it'll be avoid hitting a vehicle in front of the car at 62 miles an hour or 90 miles an hour if a collision with a vehicle is imminent. And you can read the full verbiage on our site. You can read it on NHTSA and some other places. And there's some other nuance to it as well. But, you know, it definitely could help. The feds say it'll add $82 to the price, on average, the price of a new vehicle, which I don't think anyone would notice, especially if you finance it. Like, that's not that much money. It's just, you know, not. Even, like, the cheapest new cars are in well into the thousands. You know, literally your dealer could be have missed his coffee that morning and charge your car $82 more. So, like, don't worry about the pricing. So that's how we break it down. Let us know what you think. Get in the comments. It's a good time to say, hey, podcast at autoblog.com. If you'd like to get into the mailbag, send us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Also send us your spend my monies. All right, so Fisker is, we'll end the news segment with a company that may be ending itself in short order. It has told some investors that about four companies are interested in buying it. And Henrik Fisker is selling his mansion. That's the subhead of the week as I go through the story here. The company is on the verge of bankruptcy. It's told its workers, you know, hey, literally they've basically told their workers iceberg, dead ahead. So it's not looking good for them. They did really cut prices. Though a lot of the vehicles that got the deepest price cuts, good luck finding them. So it's not looking good for Fisker, but they've done some really beautiful vehicles. So I honestly would be surprised if by the time we do this podcast at the end of June, if we haven't seen a resolution. My guess is, I don't really know what's going to happen. There's not a huge pattern where a company that actually has some credible products basically goes under or sort of is about to go under and then gets that sort of lifeboat or is sold off. I thought it might happen with Endurance. It didn't. That's Lordstown Endurance, the pickup. It didn't happen. I've often thought you might see an OEM maybe try to scoop up like a Rivian or way back like a Tesla. It just never seems to happen. So I guess to be my own devil's advocate, I don't know why that would happen here, but maybe a supplier, you know, somebody like Magna, and I'm just throwing that out there as a hypothetical, that's got a ton of money, wants to get in the car making business or something like that. But hard to say.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's such a, like, it's a weird spot to be in. Like, you have so many of these, like, startup style businesses trying to make their way. And, you know, the OEMs come along and they have this established, you know, production supply chain that they can work with. When you have the startups, a lot of what they do isn't compatible with that broader existing supply chain, or, you know, just the basic tooling isn't going to work and things like that. So all that stuff would have to be integrated into a system that likely doesn't have any compatibility factors whatsoever. I mean, you're just, you know, people trying to do it on the dime that they've got aren't operating the same way that those large OEMs are. And it's, I think, difficult for OEMs to think, well, yeah, we could integrate this process into the way we do things. We can make this brand work within our broader portfolio. And it's one of those things they kind of expect the brand to prove itself before they're willing to make an offer. But those brands aren't in a position to prove themselves because it costs way too much money to get off the ground to begin with. And so that's kind of like, we look at Scout as kind of like the perfect model of that, because they're behaving like a startup, but they have VW money behind them. And that's a huge advantage. So, like, you know, Scout's going to be in a position that companies like Fisker aren't. And it's kind of painful to watch the growing pains with smaller companies like this. But at the same time, you know, it's the auto business, and there's just, you know, there's no way to start a car company without billions of dollars to begin with. And chances are you're just going to shred every last dollar you spend. So it's never easy. And I mean, the last few years have taught us plenty about what the startup field looks like. And I agree with you that, like, the opportunity for a lot of these to get scooped up by a larger automaker has largely passed. And I just don't see anybody else, especially, like, you look at Fisker, like, they had historic ties to GM, and GM was never really all that interested in them. And you look at some of the other automakers, it's kind of been the same thing. Like Tesla, at multiple junctures, it really seemed like somebody would have come along and at least invested, if not outright bought the brand. And, you know, even if everything that's going on with Tesla right now snowballs into some sort of disaster and they actually manage to fold, there's no way the brand itself would cease to exist. Somebody's going to come along and buy the name Tesla and continue to build and supply parts for Tesla cars, just because they have way too much inertia at this point, whereas a brand like Fisker just doesn't. So, you know, it's one of those things where, like, we've passed the inflection point on most of the brands that are likely to stick around. I think the only one that's really a question mark at this point that kind of has scale but doesn't really is Rivian. And Rivian's, like, you know, they've had tons of backing from big names over the years, so, you know, that investment's come and gone, but at least they're producing viable products that customers are generally happy with, which is not something you can really say for Fisker. So
yeah, I did a story as sort of the end was nigh for Lordstown about how maybe like an automaker isn't going to jump in, but, you know, maybe this is where like some rich gazillionaire decides to hop in and buy something. And obviously that doesn't seem to take place either, you know, because the companies like a Jeff Bezos, or he's not a company, like a Jeff Bezos or an Amazon or Apple, they're almost like too smart to do it. You know, you're better off like, and the argument I made was the Washington Commanders sold for $6 billion a couple years ago. Once you get into it and you get like the cash flow from TV and ticket revenue, you've sort of got the critical mass you need to run an NFL franchise or a baseball team or whatnot. And then the value just goes up. As long as you have a decent stadium deal and you're not like a total idiot, you're not going to lose that much money. Whereas an automaker, you might as well just go set a bonfire in your backyard and start throwing $100 bills into it, even if you're doing it right. That's just what like the financials of automaking are. And then you have a good quarter and things are fine. But for a startup, to get to those good quarters, the path is often long and you know, poorly lit. So, you know, I don't know. You could probably, if you were interested in buying Fisker, you probably could get it for pennies on the dollar. But then that's the easy part. The hard part is, what do you do with it? You know, where's your $1 billion, you know, money pile in your money bin with Scrooge McDuck sending you gold coins out of it to figure out what to do in the rest of the year? So, and rich people are rich for a reason, because they're not dumb with money. And frankly, buying car companies is probably a dumb investment, at least in the short term. So,
yep.
All right. So that's Fisker. Let's talk about what we've been driving. Range Rover, the Range Rover Evoque. This is one we both got into this week. It's a lovely shade of almost like a bronze. It's, I kind of forgot about the Evoque, to be totally honest with you. The long short of it for me was, I think it looked cool. It didn't really love the powertrain. Nice interior, I thought. Wasn't thrilled with the infotainment. And it's just, you know, for just not that much more, you could get a much larger, nicer, you know, Land Rover or Range Rover. So I don't know why you wouldn't do that or look and get the cheapest Defender. So liked it, didn't love it. What did you think?
Not a fan. And that might be a bit kind, honestly.
Yeah.
It just kind of feels like you're driving a bathtub. Like it feels like weirdly tippy in a strange way that the body doesn't really kind of like suggest. Like it feels like you're buried way down low in this thing, even though it's nominally an SUV crossover type thing. You've got, you know, the big high belt line and the kind of sense that you're like looking up over the edge of this thing, which I guess is appealing to people who want to feel like they're inside some sort of rolling bunker. But it doesn't do anything for the feel of the car. It doesn't feel particularly connected to the road. It's just kind of there. It just feels like a rolling fashion accessory. So I'm not thrilled with this thing at all. The infotainment is pretty. I will give it that. The screen looks fantastic. Stands out nicely against the black of the interior, but then it would be easy to do because the whole interior is just black. So it's, you know, it's adequate transportation for somebody who really wants to be seen in an inexpensive Range Rover, but I am struggling to find too much redeeming about the way it drives. I've got a little bit more time with it this week. I'm going to have to hand it off to Joel again for a little more time behind the wheel, but I'm not sad to see it go, put it that way.
All right. Sounds good. Now, just for some context here, and we won't reveal the winner because we don't have one. Much of the, we'll say the Midwest staff got together earlier this week for a EV comparison test. So we had a few of them come through the fleet, like the Tesla Model Y and a number of other ones, including the Hyundai Ioniq 6, which we sort of tested in its own little vacuum of a test. So we wanted to talk about those. We're not going to reveal the winners here. That's going to come probably in a podcast way, you know, a few weeks out, and obviously a story, videos, all that good stuff. But just to give you some impressions of these vehicles, because we haven't driven them. Hey, let's talk about it. The Evoque was basically a support car, is I guess the way I would put it. Thus, we got to get through it. But yeah, that's, you know, it was fine. It's, again, it's my least favorite Rover, I guess, at the moment. So.
Same.
Ioniq 6, this was my second time driving it. Was this your first time?
Yeah, first for me.
Okay. I think it's a very nice car. What did you think?
I genuinely enjoyed it. And I got this one a little ahead of the test, and we also used it as kind of a support vehicle of a sort. And it was a bit too expensive to be included with the rest of the EVs that we actually had, so that was the real reason why it wasn't part of the larger evaluation. But, I mean, a wonderful car, very comfortable, drives very nicely. The one complaint that I had about it, and it honestly, it doesn't actually pertain to me, but it was something that I noticed. We were using it as kind of like a seating office while people were getting in and out of the rain. And I was sitting in the back seat with Jeremy Korzenewski, and Jeremy could not sit in the back seat without his head pretty much resting against the ceiling, which is kind of surprising given like the bubble shape to the rear of the greenhouse. Like they kind of went out of their way to make the back end kind of bulbous, which you'd think would prevent headroom issues. And Jeremy's not crazy tall. He's like 6 feet, maybe 6'1", 6'2", at the most. He's not, it just happens to be tall in the torso, and it put his head right up against the ceiling. So that was just a kind of surprising thing. That and the very limited trunk height. Mm-hmm. When you look at the car, it looks like it's kind of a fastback, but the trunk opening is so small. It's kind of shifted to the very back of the car. It's kind of a weird little clamshell. And there's no real like fastback shape to the trunk itself. So you just get a very clipped off top area and then a tiny little bit of trunk space that kind of tucks up underneath the hatch looking glass, but there's no actual volume to be used there. So I went to pick up some plants with it, for example, and had to put them all in the back seat because they were too tall to fit in the trunk, and they were only, you know, maybe 2 feet tall. So it's not like we're, you know, talking about anything unreasonable here. It's just kind of surprising given the shape of the car. So just, you know, some little things that we noticed that we may not have otherwise picked out in testing just because the way we happened to be using the car, but it was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's some trade-offs with the, you know, that beautiful design, but, you know, not to be not unexpected. I think, again, though, overall, though, that trade-off, I would pay that price of admission. That was a beautiful looking car. I think you don't see this kind of design anymore. Hyundai has been taking risks, not just with even like the EVs, where they've taken a lot of risks with, you know, the with this car, the Ioniq 5 as well, which gives you that kind of 1980s vibe. But also even the last couple generations of the Sonata have often been, yeah, you know, risk takers. This one was not part of the test because it came in at 55 grand, a little bit more. I liked the interior. It was kind of like a gray. It was just gray, but it was still nicely done. The outside was onyx black, which is a really, like, it almost had, it wasn't shiny, but when the sun hit it, it had that kind of old school, like really stately look, which, you know, was great. I think it, it looked luxurious. It was a lot of fun to drive too. It's, you know, this is a long range model, 20 inch wheels. So, I, you know, when they first revealed this thing, I thought, oh, this is niche. It's like this kind of like 1930s style sedan. No, thank you. Kia EV6, Hyundai Ioniq 5. That's what I would look for off of this platform. And as we were leaving, I saw some dude juicing up his Ioniq 5. And I was like, oh, man, I haven't seen one of these in person. Yeah, maybe in a few months. And I was really, you know, really taken by it. But of the three, I don't even know which of the three I would take, but I really enjoyed the Ioniq 6. I think, I don't know, I'd probably do, would I do the EV6, the Kia? Maybe, because overall I like that one the most, but it's like, they're all very good. So, and, you know, when you start breaking down different packages and options, you really could get beneath the skin because all three of them are pretty attractive vehicles. Do you have a favorite of the three?
I actually think the Ioniq 6 might be my favorite now. And like for all the bagging I did on the back seat, it does have an astronomical amount of rear leg room. In fact, if the rear bench were like 3 or 4 inches closer to the front seats, the headroom wouldn't be an issue because the ceiling height is actually higher right behind the rear seats than it is as you move farther back. So they kind of, I don't know, I feel like a decision was made there to favor the leg room over the headroom, and it just worked out that way. I mean, I could practically like lie down on my back and have my knees just touching the driver's seat behind Joel, who is again like 6 feet tall. So like it's a good roomy cabin. I feel like I'm bagging on it a little unfairly just because it lacks a little headroom in the back. But just, you know, things like that, that, you know, unintended consequences, right? You got all that leg room that take advantage of all that packaging space, but you just, you lose a little bit in headroom by taking advantage of it. So, but yeah, I would agree. It's like, as a total package, a great car. It's interesting and nice to look at and very nice to drive. So cool. No complaints.
It's funny. I don't know if everybody went quite as far as you did, but that was the mood for, as the, a lot of the editors got through the Ioniq 6. It was like, oh, wow. Okay. Wait a minute. This is really good. We like this. This is cool. So I drove one last fall. It was like a pretty cold, rainy October night. And I mean, that was also a memorable drive. This is one of those press cars that when you get into it, you like it, stays with you. It has presence. It has gravitas. It's, you know, I don't think the dynamics are amazing, but certainly powerful. It looks good. Reminds you of how fun a sedan would be. I don't know if they actually call this thing a sedan. I mean, that's what it is. It's got a curvy fastback thing, but yeah, cool. So let's move along to, let's jump in with a long-term update on the WRX. You were in that for a while. What do you think?
Yeah, so we just got that one over to the Subaru dealership this week to get swapped over to its original summer rubber and take off the winter tires. So it's out of my hands and back with Zach for a little bit. But so this is kind of a wrap up of my time with it, I suppose, before I get to play with it on the summer rubber a little bit more. But I mean, it's been absolutely fantastic. Put more mileage on this than any of the long-term cars that I've had while it's been loaned to me, just because it's been so much fun to drive, so easy to hop behind the wheel of and just, you know, go do your thing. Really, really no complaints apart from just the things that are limited by either the trim or the fact that it's, you know, an inexpensive sports sedan. I would love to have a heated steering wheel and it doesn't, so there was that. But just, I mean, really, like, apart from, you know, how you'd actually have it built, I just genuinely enjoyed that car. The only real shortcomings it has compared to, say, like a VW GTI or a GLI or something like that is that the gearing is a little bit shorter, so it's a little noisier on the highway. It's a little buzzier. The engine's revving a little higher, so it's, you're just going to notice it. And it's just a little tinnier, a little, you know, just not quite as refined as anything you're going to get from the Germans, but certainly, you know, about as nice as you're going to expect from like a Hyundai Elantra N or something like that. So I'm just really thrilled with it. I've really connected with this in a way that I've never really connected with a WRX previously. So we're talking like a 5-star car for me. I'm really thrilled with it. I would recommend it to anybody looking for something fun and practical in a sedan. It's just like, it's really hard to beat, especially for the price, because it is quite affordable.
What CDs did you listen to of it?
My Wallflower CD, the Bringing Down the Horse, got extended play. I listened to that a couple times, and also through it, I have some like some older Dave Matthews concert CDs and stuff like that that are good for listening to the stereo. But as I learned with the winter tires on there, kind of hard to listen to the stereo over the tire noise from time. So it's not, you know, not a perfect package by any means, but at the same time, it was still fun to be able to break out the old CD case and actually listen to some optical for once.
Bringing Down the Horse, I can't think of, well, I can think of, but that is one of the probably top five most like iconic, like 90s genre, you know, tunes. I had that disc, loved it. Looking back, like the rundown here is like every song you would hear on buses to different sporting events, school dances. I almost feel like, not that the car knows this, but I almost feel sorry for the car, because all these like geriatric millennial Gen Y, Gen X editors are throwing in these like Counting Crows, Dave Matthews CDs, like, right. You know, this is what, you know, we're writing about, is let's, you know, get one headlight and dust that off. But hey, we're at that age.
Yeah, right.
All right. So that album is actually, I believe, 7 years older than Tesla, which I guess is a good thing to close out the drive section with. Tesla Model Y. This is the first time I've driven it. Have you driven the Model Y before?
Same for me. Okay. First time.
Yeah. So Tesla doesn't do press cars currently. They used to. I remember once they delivered a Model S to me at a hotel. They gave us one for Tech of the Year in 2014. So it obviously was a different time, but they don't usually do them now. So we Turo'd this Model Y. It was, I think it was a 21, had about 40,000 miles on it. So we definitely baked that into it. But the idea was to measure the car, you know, overlook just the used car qualities of it, but measure it as a product. And I don't know, this could be one of the more divisive ones when we get down the, and that could be, it probably will when we look at the Comparo, but just, you know, driving a Model Y, been hearing about this car for years. Here's how I break it down. I like how it looks. The interior, even putting away the wear and tear, is almost shockingly barren. I was okay with the infotainment. I found it pretty easy to use, easier than, I mean, many newer systems. I thought it was fine. I know some people don't like it, but I thought it was fine. And I think it also added an element of, it was a bit of a design flourish because the rest of the car was so barren. The interior, that is, I didn't like there was no thought put into the interior layout either. Like, I didn't know where to put anything, really. Keys, coffee, phone, there was no good spot for any of it, but it was fast as hell. And again, it looks pretty good. Generally speaking, I like quick, you know, stylish American sedans. So that's kind of where I landed. I enjoyed my time in it. What did you think?
Very, very similar, really. Like you, the interior was quite jarring to me. I've been in Teslas before. I should have known what I was getting into in that regard, and was still struck by just how plain everything is. And on top of that, ours had like the person who rented it to us had installed like sparkly floor mats and,
yeah, that was
and
weird.
Some like some protective things and things like that that kind of livened the interior up a little bit. And still, even with those, it felt very dreary in there. And I mean, it just kind of felt like at some point, like somebody had produced a fairly decent electric chassis, and then Tesla as a company kind of come along and coach built this cabin on top of it. You know, like it doesn't feel like a holistic, unified product. It feels like a chassis with a body thrown on it. And I mean, that's not what it is, right? Like, it's, you know, these are unibody. I mean, Tesla was trying to get into the whole like one piece gigacasting thing. They were literally trying to make the whole car one piece, and obviously that's falling by the wayside now, as we've learned this week. But still, like, you would think that something that was designed ground up to be as unified as this car is would feel like it, and it doesn't. And it was pointed out to me before that Tesla went for a very kind of sporty ride from the very get-go with all of their cars. And the Model Y is certainly no exception. I mean, the low center of gravity, it hugs the ground like nothing else. And it is very firmly sprung. I mean, we took it on a stretch of Hines Drive here in the park. And it's just, I mean, it's a bad surface. And the Tesla told us just how bad it was constantly. It was borderline punishing to drive, even at very normal rush hour speeds. We're not talking about pushing this thing at all. We're talking 40 to 45, maybe pushing 50. And just, you know, the constant jacking motions going over every single bump, just jiggling every loose part of your body. It is a surprisingly punishing ride for a car that isn't otherwise all that performance oriented. I mean, sure, it's quick, but you know, it's not a sports car or anything like that. So it's a little, I don't know, discontinuous, if you will. But I mean, all in, I mean, I actually was surprised how intuitive the infotainment system was to use. I was driving it in the rain and like had to use the windshield wipers and things like that. And none of them worked the way you'd think they would coming from another car, but they were pretty easy to figure out. You know, press the wiper button and then adjust the speed and everything on the screen. It was a little weird to like not use the same control to do both things. But given what all the other automakers are doing lately, it actually didn't feel all that odd. Like it's something that Tesla's kind of inspired in other people. And I'm not going to say for better or for worse, because it is just worse, but it's at least something that we become a little bit more used to with all the wild attempts that have been made to replicate it lately. So yeah, I mean a mixed bag. And honestly, I would love to drive one of those with 40,000 normal use miles and not potentially 40,000 rental use miles, just for comparison, because that thing did, I mean, it was squeaky like a New York cab squeaky. Like I'm not even going to pretend that it was pleasant in there. It wasn't. But it's easy to attribute that to hard use, especially if we're talking about 40,000 miles of it. Because if you've ever been in a rental car with even a quarter of those miles, it's probably sounded just as bad as that thing did. So, you know, it's hard to hold that against it given the circumstances.
I can see why people buy them, though. It's, you know, a great comparison. I've used this a little spuriously on the podcast, especially, is the Apple iPhone SE. Cheapest iPhone, still an iPhone though. And I think for some people, an electric car is still a Tesla. And, you know, even without all the baggage that goes along with the company's founder and other things, Tesla is still so ubiquitous. You get into one, the prices, I mean, I almost am hesitant to quote a price because they just keep dropping and sometimes going up. Still very competitive. The car is doing gangbusters in other global markets. It's a very popular car. It definitely seems to strike a vein with, you know, electric, you know, vehicle buyers. I think they're willing to overlook some things that they definitely would not in other cars. Like if this were it, Tesla's a domestic company. If you got in a Chevy and the interior looked like this, you would be like, this looks worse than my Buick Citation from the 1980s. But with Tesla, you're like, oh, but wait, it's electric. It's okay. I think we've gone over this with Tesla products in the past. They could really compensate and have a more fully baked execution with some of the quality issues they have just by hiring more people and investing in that area. And the chassis are always scattershot. You know, on the other hand, to use another domestic example, look at all the different Mopar muscle cars where we're like, well, they look good. They're fast. They're kind of crazy to drive. They're not exactly tuned like, you know, for Monaco, and we give them a break. So that's kind of what people do with Tesla, I think, to do that mental calibration.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, there are some little things that Tesla doesn't do that other automakers do that would make, I think, a lot of people happy. Like things like, you know, Android Auto, Apple CarPlay integration and things like that. That just nice little quality of life changes. But it's a car that, you know, when you see how happy people are driving them, even without those little things that you expect from automakers these days, I mean, it kind of just goes to show that they've managed to target their customers very effectively. I mean, we can hate it as car enthusiasts, but, you know, it doesn't change whether it's selling or not. And right. I mean, it's not like this is the first time there's been a car like that. I mean, you know, when Toyota in the 90s was building a lot of things that car enthusiasts didn't want to drive, but it wasn't making Toyota any less successful for it. So, you know, we have to remember sometimes that we don't represent the broader market the way we'd like to. And this is one of those examples where like our sensibilities conflict with those of a lot of buyers. At the same time, I mean, there have been a lot of people who've gone into Tesla and had to bounce right back out for the same reasons that we often cite. So we're not wrong. We're not always right. But it's controversial for a reason.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
I wonder, you know, and they've talked about the decontented Teslas. That's a mouthful. I mean, how much lower content could you get than this? You know, Elon Musk said in their earnings statement, I think last week, how, hey, you know, we will do this cheaper car that he previously, you know, said they kind of wouldn't. And there's some debate. Is that the Model 2, like a new vehicle, or is it just like Model Y maybe, or a Model 3 that's even more decontented? So, I mean, I don't know. I don't think he has any room to swing any lower with just like materials and other things. But, you know, he could make the infotainment smaller. You know, that could save a little bit of money. Maybe, you know, come up with like a, you know, more concise options and colors list. And it's like you almost go back to like the Model T. You know, you can have it in like, well, it was one color back then, but like three colors or something. So maybe that's how he does it. But I mean, just from a raw materials quality perspective, like you can't do like a, hey, we're not gonna do any leather, we're not gonna, it's like it, this is what you're getting right now. So
yeah,
cool.
And I think another common complaint from the staff too, which this is something that other people are dabbling in a little bit, or other automakers are dabbling in a little bit, is the idea that the Model Y doesn't have a cluster or anything to replace a cluster. It just has the center infotainment screen, and it's functional. I mean, that's where, you know, your speed readout, all your instrumentation is integrated into that, and they put it as close to the kind of left side so that it would be in your sort of field of view at least as well as they possibly could. But it would be really nice to see Tesla do like a nice HUD or some sort of cluster display solution that doesn't require you having to look over toward the center. Having that information right in front of you is always better than having it slightly in front of you. That's, you know, that it's always going to be better if you can get it right there.
Cool.
All right. Did this change your thoughts on Tesla at all? Maybe it's what you expected. I mean, for me, it was cool to drive it. But it didn't really change. Like, it's kind of like, oh, I finally got in this car. Great. It didn't really change my opinion, though, of like what the car is, or the company, I should say.
Yeah. It pretty much met my expectations. The only thing that I will say that it recalibrated slightly was my feelings toward that infotainment setup, because it is fairly intuitive to use. It's not Apple levels of easy. It's not something that anyone can just jump in and instantly use, but it presented a much less aggressive learning curve than I was expecting, especially just coming from other automakers who are trying to do the same thing and aren't doing it even as well as Tesla is. And that's a pretty low bar to clear. So that was the one thing that really kind of stood out to me. I was pleasantly surprised by both the way the infotainment presents useful information and how easy it was to navigate.
Yeah,
no, I agree with that. And I think that is another strength for Tesla, is how good the UX is in their cars. That's very Apple-like. So, all right. Well, let's see. On the comparison dinner, I believe you had the fish, right?
Yeah, sea bass.
The sea bass. I had that as well. I think that was very good. I had a Stella in one of those chalices they bring out, which I have a couple of those in my fridge. That's a nice, you know, it's very warm out. Cut the grass this week and had a Heineken, but it's almost to the point of the year where you want to shift into like the lighter wheat beers and things like that. But I also had an Oberon recently and very much enjoyed it. When the temperatures get above 70 and you're sipping an Oberon, the world feels right. So that is my beer recommendation. Any recommendations for that, or any books or records? I don't know if you want to swing back to the 90s and tell people to go pick out a Wallflowers disc. Any life recommendations?
If you think you want a new garage, get a new garage.
Yeah.
that's my, I'm very excited about this. It's completely taken over my consciousness this week. So that's completely where I'm fixated, but it's amazing what a little extra space can do for you.
I would like a new garage floor. That's very, it's not like super high on the list, But when I think about like cleaning out the garage and then doing that would be a nice life hack, life upgrade. So I don't know. I don't think that's going to creep into like a this year upgrade, because once you get into May, you kind of need to have that, you know, that your plan for the summer and the fall of the upgrades. And we just did the siding. So, I mean, upgrades, resources have been spent. I don't know if the garage is going to get any attention, but that's a really good point. No new garage for me, but maybe a floor. We'll see.
All right. Good luck.
All right. If you enjoy the show, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the podcast. Leave us a 5-star review if you're so inclined. It helps us get the word out, helps us connect with other car fans who might want to know about car-related podcasts. Send us your Spend My Monies. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Shout out to our producer, Eric Meyer. Thank you for making us sound good this week and every week. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next time.